Welcome to Season 1 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with disability leaders each week about career, life, and technology. I'm Nikki Nolan.
And I'm Sam Prue.
Let's get into this. To start, we would love for you to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Hector Osborne Rodriguez. I pronounce our E-M. I'm Latino skin, so I'm kind of like a mix between white and black, but I'm mostly like we call cinnamon color. Cinnamon color. I wear glasses. I have a beard now because it's winter, and that's pretty much it. I'm front-end development manager for Accenture.
Thank you so much for being here. We would love to know your story and what got you into that line of work.
It's an interesting path, I will say. So I have like two versions of my life. I'm a computer engineer. The reason I studied computer engineering was to escape from my father's life of being a doctor. So he was always away from home. I was like, no, I don't want to do that stuff or whatever. So my first job was as a consultant. And what happened? I travel around the world. So I didn't choose the right career, apparently.
Yeah, the tech sector, that career where you famously get to stay at home and never work any overtime. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I chose the right one. But anyways, when they invent time travel, I will go back and let myself know that it doesn't work that way.
That's right.
So my belief was to use technology to help people, right? Like I have a lot of people with disabilities at home. My mom passed away recently. She had autoimmune disease all her life. I like to talk about her because she changed my life. And she's the reason I chose this career path, right? Like I saw her living through lupus. So her life was not the greatest and she missed a lot of things in her life. So when I started computer engineering, halfway through my career, I started web development. And I learned what accessibility for web was. So, oh my goodness, how come I not have ever been trained on this? Because during my career, I think it wasn't even mentioned. There were accessibility through my entire university career, which is sad. But we're here. I learned about it and self-driven, passionate, studied on it. And, you know, we live and breathe accessibility every day.
Do you think that's changed the folks you see coming up? And I mean, I know we talk a lot about accessibility now, and there's, I think, maybe a lot more awareness, but have we started giving people the training that they ought to have, do you think?
If you ask anyone that works in the accessibility field, they will say, we would love more. So things are changing. The word is out there. It's not like a mystery that accessibility is out there. I live in Toronto, Canada. So Canada is like really passionate about accessibility. We have like multiple laws, right? Like AODA is ahead of the game. People want to do it. So even for those that have never been educated, the law is forcing them to learn about accessibility, at least to know that there is a requirement. What I think we could improve is in the education, right? We don't have an accessibility career. We don't have an accessibility practitioner. I see that companies are now starting to have their own accessibility offices, which is fantastic. You open like career websites, LinkedIn, and you start seeing now accessibility chief officer. So it's something that you want to look forward to. I want to grow and I want to fill that position. What do I have to do to go there? I think it used to be that accessibility was only for physical spaces. Now that we have transitioned to digital world, I think we can do better.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you run Ally Tips account. What influenced you to start accessibility resource sharing online?
I think we're not having the proper education for people. And sharing knowledge is a passion. I think everyone in this space is really open. When I started learning about accessibility, I met so many people that were open doors. Right? Like they, you can ask them questions. Like there's like a Slack groups, Teams group or channel. Like you can just go to conferences or meetups when we go back after pandemic and you meet the people that write the rules, that write the books and they're so open and the knowledge is just shared. I thought, okay, my perspective, I did designing at the beginning of my career and then I started web development. So I have that perspective that transitions between the two areas of the world. And I figure, you know what? I'm going to share the things that I learned. And I work in e-commerce for the last 11 years or 12 years, where I think there is a gap in e-commerce being the one that typically has the most issues in accessibility. And we don't speak about specifically for e-commerce, what's happening there? Like why is an e-commerce website having issues? So the reason I started that account was to share that knowledge. And yeah, here we are. and I'm trying to improve it. It was a personal goal to like, let me write at least one article per month. We are on the 27 and I have not written my article yet, but I will.
Hey, right after this interview. No, maybe we'll inspire you. There you go. There you go. But I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in the accessibility industry and the accessibility community recently around platforms. I think things really kicked off maybe a year ago when platforms like Clubhouse and Green Room and some of the others were starting to exist, and there was no captions. And yet there was a lot of accessibility advocacy being done in these spaces. And there were accessibility groups and things like that. And I know we hear a lot of criticism of like Twitter and Facebook and all of the social media platforms as not being as accessible and as inclusive as they should be. How do you think about the platforms where you put your stuff and the platforms where you post and the platforms where you share your learnings? Do you think it is most important for you to be in inaccessible spaces and to share all of that knowledge? Or do you try to say, well, I'm only going to participate in spaces that are accessible to everyone? And I don't think there's a right answer here. I'm just interested to hear your thinking.
It's a great question. Some people will love me. Some people will hate me. But I use those applications that are accessible for me. I will say that, right? Like the ones that I can use, I will use them. I can put myself in the spotlight saying that I remember when Clubhouse was announced and started, you got a lot of heated debate on it, a lot of hate and a lot of love, depending on who you were talking about, right? I believe accessibility is also part of diversity and inclusion. Right. So something that I can use, maybe the next person next to me might not be using, but we shouldn't shorten the spaces. I think it's more about inclusion. So let's make sure that the applications are doing better. I understand social media like Twitter, which also gets a lot of heated debate, now has an office. The last year, I think they started their accessibility office and they're trying to do some changes. So let's trust. Let's trust the system. Let's trust the people that are working in those offices and support them. Right, like we all trying to make an inclusive world and a better world. So let's do it together. I find that in our space, we tend to be overly critical sometimes. So we have to like I tell to my kids, like breathe, just hold down, breathe, hold the 3 seconds and then speak, right? Like, so that we don't hit that hate all the time out. So
yeah. And I think there's an argument to be made that if it wasn't for people with disabilities on Twitter and Facebook and Clubhouse and Slack and Google and all of these other places, that maybe they wouldn't have changed. They wouldn't have made the changes that they're trying to make if the community wasn't already insisting on being there.
Totally. So there is a balance of being vocal. I think it's the good cop and the bad cop kind of situation. You need those that are like really vocal, like tan, 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 hitting all the time. You also need the softer hand to help those that are working in. But I completely agree with you. Like if you weren't for the community speaking for themselves, I think no one would have advocated for them, right? Like, and that's what we have now, like the human rights laws and all of those things that came because the community spoke.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how we segue out of that topic. It's just something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, actually, as I up my use of Clubhouse.
I guess we could segue into this next question, which is like, what can companies do better to educate and train all employees to be inclusive and create more accessible products?
That's a good debate and a good topic that I talked to my company and companies that I work with. Typically, they want to improve in accessibility, right? Like, and my advice is always, you need people with disabilities in your offices. That's critical, right? Like, you can read all of the documentation in the world about how disability works or how a computer is used or whatever. You don't know the ways a person needs to go around technology to be able to use it. The only time that you get to see that if you have someone sitting next to you. It also lowers the barrier of uncomfortableness if you had never interacted with people with disability, right? I find that some of my colleagues that never worked with someone with PWD, like they don't know how to ask, they don't know how to talk. And it's just that weird moment. It's like the first date, right? Like that weird moment that you don't know, like, should I like lean forward? Do I drink first? Or like, do I say hello? Do I give a handshake? It's that weirdness. So having people with disability in offices is automatically an advancement for the companies, right? Like you learn through them, they give you new experiences. The second part that I recommend for companies is training, right? Like get everyone in training, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 2 hours, 3 hours, start somewhere, like 15 minutes per week, like just somewhere. just do a little pieces, right? Like we all start, like, and from the 100% of employees that are in your company, maybe only 1%, 10% will love this and will become the advocate of your company, right? Then get those groups. This is the third advice. Get that group, that 10%, get them together, create an accessibility champion network. Get them together, get them passionate, get them working together. Like those type of groups get like super inspiring and they're always up to date in what's happening in the law on new technology, new platform. Like, hey, Netflix announced this or whatever. Like they listen. They listen to use cases in other companies that went wrong. And then you might say, hey, this happens to X company, so let's not do that. That network is super, it's just amazing.
Training and inclusion. This is where we stop to plug the place that I work. No, I'm kidding. As you were sort of talking about inclusion in companies and working next to and with people with disabilities, there was a time many hundreds of years ago when we could work in offices and COVID wasn't a thing. But there was a time when we worked in person, we worked in offices and we worked together. Now we are moving to be online first. And that is very flexible. And it has made it easier in some ways to include people with disabilities. But is it perhaps, and I want to know what you think about this, is it maybe in some ways minimizing or erasing our differences, right? If you sit on Slack all day with someone with a physical disability, are you necessarily going to know and are you going to learn from them the same way that you might if you were sitting physically next to them in person? Have we lost something or has it all been made up? Because now that we're remote, we're being more inclusive and we're hiring more people with disabilities. So like we're just gaining.
There are pros and cons of the digital transformation that we're going on right now. I think it was push, it was force, right? Like we were not ready for this. The world changed and like, hey, you cannot go to offices now. Sorry, you had to do things online. The first month of pandemic, we closed grocery stores. Like you were not able to go anywhere. And then you started like online shopping. I can't imagine how many people got left out because they could not do groceries, right? Like presential, like they couldn't go. So either they spend more money getting things that they should not, or those kind of issues just came because of pandemic. So to answer your question, if have we improved, I guess in certain perspective, we can say, yeah. You can work now wherever you can, right? Like anywhere. Like you can be, I don't know, in a beautiful summer beach instead of being here looking at the snow like I am in a summer cool breeze, like no one knows like where you are kind of thing. You could like the background. So that change, right?
I can say working from experience, if there is an employee in Colombia, they will send pictures and taunt the entire team with how nice that beach is over all of December. Speaking from direct, no, I'm kidding. But yes, continue.
I mean, it opens that, right? Like, I mean, that's stream, but it opens the opportunity for those that could not travel to the office, right? Like, let's say in winter, right? Snow is a limiting and it's a blocker for many, many people. So now let's say during the winter season, you can, you know, skip that travel, that commuting that is both, but it also has closed the doors, right? Like online technology that we're using today for meetings and Zoom, Teams, those kind of things, if they're not hosted accessibly, we are leaving some people out, like with the technology that we have today. So yes, we have helped some, we have blocked some. And the thing with accessibility and inclusion is like, it's so broad and so big that sometimes you try to help a group and then unfortunately you block others. So trying to be more inclusive is one thing that is hard. And like I said earlier, just one day at a time and like 15 minutes at a time, right? Like let's try to help and include more and more people.
It's a really interesting topic because I feel like I enjoy not having to commute and I also don't have to mask as much, you know, because when I'm in person, I have to mask and it's emotionally exhausting. However, being dyslexic, having to predominantly write, all of a sudden my disability is so visible to everybody. Yeah.
Something that you made me think about that is totally unrelated to what we're talking about. There is a group of people who think that they are being helpful when they correct people's spelling and grammar in a professional setting, in like a Zoom. Is that
it's ableist.
Do we need to stop?
It is classist and it is ableist to like be a grammar police. It is
But it happens in any social media or anywhere that you work. I think it's a human nature of I'm correct and you're not. Like,
I agree.
It's that nature of like, I don't know, something's going on in my life, but I need to say to someone else that I'm better. So that it happens. And English is my second language. So I have certain pronunciations that can be misinterpreted. Like words like beach or like focus or other words that I don't hear them. I swear to God, I don't hear them.
It took me a second to hear it. Yeah, when I was learning Italian, beach was one of the ones that's a funny one.
Exactly, right? So that's spoken. So written, I can imagine how many issues we have, right?
Does that, I mean, when we talk about accessibility and we talk about diversity and we talk about the problems and the solutions that have been caused, I don't think we talk enough about that. I mean, you probably go to meetings that use auto captions and where people depend on those captions. I think we've gotten past the point where people make fun of our colleagues' accents. I hope.
Yeah.
I hope we've gotten past that. But does it cause you problems now in an online environment where like somebody needs the captions to work and they're just not working for you because they were all trained on like people who sound like me?
It happens. So I will tell you my experience with the new UI. So we're used to like devices and stuff like that, but now we have voice UI. Siri, for instance, wasn't my best friend for many, many years because I have an accent, so it wasn't trained for my language. So I never use a voice command, or I called certain financial institutions and then the voice command was like, it needed to be voice activated. So say what you want. I want to open an account. Sorry, I cannot understand you. I want to open an account. I cannot understand you. Account. Operator, just get me out of here, please. Like, so frustrating. So it happens a lot. And the other thing, like me having my second language as my working language, there's one thing that is a limiter for me. I cannot do math in English.
Oh.
Like, I cannot. Like, you tell me an equation or like 2 + 2, like that's a simple one. But if you go a little bit deeper, I like stop numbers for me. I need to go back to my Spanish. See them, understand them, and then go back. So it's a limiter and it's a stopper for me. And it happens quite often. So at the end of the day, like I say to my wife, I don't want to speak English anymore. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I'm just like, sorry, I'm so tired.
It's all good.
I'm like, I'm so tired at the end of the day. Like my brain is just like, I'm sorry. So we call that moment the mumbly Hector. The mumbly Hector is here between 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. We know that. If it was a stressful day at work, his language is just awful.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been around a lot of people who English is their second, third, fourth language. And it just a lot of people, I don't think, realize how taxing that is on the brain to have to context shift in different languages. So you do a lot of work with accessibility. And I'm really curious, how does accessibility drive innovation?
I see it in two areas, at least in my line of work, right? Like in the web development area. So first, let's start with the typical one. The reactive area. So an issue is found. Someone did an audit in your application or your website, something is not working. So the innovation is driven like, how do we fix this? So you have to go and find out what is being used in the world. So you go, that's the remediation part, right? Like something is broken. How do we fix this? And there are multiple ways that you can do it, right? Like there's so many ways that it opens your mind that I never thought about this. I never thought about how to solve this. On the left-hand side, where it's like when you start gathering either requirements or design, that's super creative too. I'm going to put you an example. I'm a gamer. I like gaming. I like gaming platforms. So I love that area. I also love accessibility or the gaming accessibility aspect because I learned how like controls are not accessible for everyone. So I love to see the solutions that are created by people with disabilities to be able to game. It's just amazing. It's super creative. Like, you know, you use like a pencil to hit the button and then you hit against the screen and against the wall. That's just creative because the end goal is to play a game, but you have to navigate through this blocker in order for you to make it happen. I think that drives innovation, right? Like, it's just seeing how do you just like, your goal is just have fun. Right? So you navigate, you traverse to that. So yeah, I hope that answered the question or opens more because I know Samuel will have more questions than answers.
It did. And it's something that I talk about and think about a lot. And I was super interested that you brought up gaming because one of the interesting things about gaming, if you break it down to its core, is that what you have to do to play a computer game is you have to get information that you are able to process, and then you have to have a way to react to that information extremely quickly. And so I wonder, what we can learn, and we as in the non-gaming communities, we design our websites and our apps. I wonder if there are techniques that we can learn from gaming, because like, isn't that what we want to do at the office? Get large amounts of information quickly so we can process it and act quickly on it.
That's the hope, right? Like I use gaming conferencing and gaming accessibility conferences and experiences a lot because their findings are amazing. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Ubisoft discovered that users left the captions in their games if they were on by default. So you open a game, if the closed captions were on, people didn't go to the settings to disable them. They leave them there, whatever. If the opposite were to happen, if the game has the captions hidden, only 47% of the people went in and enabled them. So it's that difference. So that data I love, because like, why don't we have auto captions in our viewing screens and things like that, right? Like I just kind of drop that bullet there and that little drop of knowledge, and I think we should use it.
Yeah. And it's very interesting to look at what people are doing when they're trying to have fun. Because if we could make our work apps more fun, maybe we would make, well, I don't know that we can make filing our quarterly reports more fun, but you know what I'm getting at.
Well, work, we spend more time at work sometimes than at home, right? Like we're in offices sparring with people, and luckily we don't have to commute now, so we save that time. But we spend a lot of time with our colleagues. We create relationships with them that are different than our relationships at home. So why should not we have fun in our working environments? Right? I mean, it should. So yeah, there's that.
And I mean, we can just replace the commute. We can just require everyone to play Forza for, you know, about 30 minutes before they get into work. And then
that would be amazing. Yeah. Well, speaking of Forza, could you talk about receiving information and slow it down? Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, Forza has an option to do so.
Yeah.
Where you can slow down the game for the time reaction. Right, like you have,
yeah.
And I find that just a miss, right? Like it just, again, the thing is to game, the thing is to have fun. So why don't we make it fun for all of us, right?
Yeah, the work that Forza has been doing is something that I'm really interested in and following very closely, and has highlighted for me accessibility and inclusion. Sort of one of the things that we don't talk about is like for who, because Forza has so many great accessibility options, and so many of my friends who have never been able to play a this kind of game before now can, but like, I can't because we're not quite there. And it's just really interesting to me that like, they've made a game that is award-winning and is accessible and is revolutionary, and it is, but like, there's still people who for whatever reason can't, which is not a criticism of Forza. They're doing great work. It highlights for me, I guess, that we need to define the problem space better, maybe.
Yeah, there's a barrier, right? Like there's a barrier of entry that certain companies are trying to close or like open, I would say, I don't know what, like remove the barrier, let's say.
Yeah.
I think they're getting better. They're not there, but they're getting better. They're trying. And I think setting the standards, because I think like Ian Hamilton and their team created the accessibility gaming standards, which is helping other companies try to follow them, adhere to them. As we know, standards shouldn't be just the thing, but it helps. At least get a default background to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, gaming and things is like a whole other season.
That'd be a fun season because I literally know nothing about it. So I don't even know what
this
game
is. Oh, there
you go. Can you tell me about this game? I don't know anything about this game. Tell me what it is.
It's a car driving game. I will say that. It's like a driving game. You drive vehicles, so you can choose any car in the world and you just drive it to places. This one is set in Mexico. Super fun. Like super, super fun game.
Oh,
there's like races and competitions and stuff like that. But I mean, yeah, it's kind of flight simulator for cars in a very real way.
It is.
Interesting. It is. Yeah. Maybe they can partner up with like Google's AR, like self-describing stuff, and then it can be accessible to you, Sam.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, but that's the interesting thing, right? If they make a Forza that is fully accessible, I mean, we're at the point now where the realism is such that if I can play Forza, I'm basically driving. So can't we just sort of put the sensors on the car? Or, like, I don't know. It's just interesting.
Yeah. I mean, who knows, right? Maybe one day. We don't know yet. Yeah.
Before we get to our next question, let's take a quick break to talk about our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Shane, the platform coordinator at Fable. I'm a full-time screen magnification user. And before becoming the platform coordinator, I started out as a member of our community of accessibility testers. Now I help support Fable's customers as they work with us to best engage people with disabilities in every part of their research, testing, and development. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your accessibility journey. Fable can help you do that, from improving your team's accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage. We can help you take the next step on your accessibility journey. To learn more, check out our website at makeitfable.com.
Now that we've heard from our sponsor, let's continue the interview.
Well, let's transition into, like, what problem have you solved that you're very proud of or that you're incredibly proud of?
I don't know if it was a problem, but here's a success story that I have regarding accessibility. So I was working for a government agency and they didn't have an accessibility office. So the project that I was in, they had no advocates for accessibility. And I brought my own little flag, you know, hey, we should care for this government. Like, I mean, let's set the example, et cetera, et cetera. But that got me into trouble, might have impeded my career progression for 1 year or so because I was vocal. That's the sad part. But the good part is that the leads of those organizations and projects that I were working in, they left for different companies. And many, many years later, now I know that they're opening their own accessibility offices in the companies that they're working on today. So even though we had battles and fights or whatever you want to call them, heated debates while we were working together afterwards, and as still of today, they called me to ask me for suggestions and they're opening their own accessibility offices in the company that I'm in. So it was a long career, long years before I saw that the tree gave fruits, but it was sweet. It was really sweet.
One of the questions that I get a lot as I talk to people about accessibility, my official title is accessibility evangelist, so it's what I do a lot. One of the questions that I get is my organization or the organization, you know, whoever where they're working, isn't interested in accessibility, isn't doing it. How do we change things from below, right? It's a designer or a web developer asking me, how do I get the organization interested in web accessibility? And so as someone who tried to do it and maybe wasn't unsuccessful, based on that experience, what maybe would you have done differently? Or do you think it was just something where, like, it wasn't the time and they weren't ready and it wasn't going to happen? And no matter what I did, it wouldn't have worked.
I have so many experiences you reflect back and you think, like, did I do the right thing? I don't tend to dwell too much on them. I grew up as an athlete. I used to be a swimmer, and in swimming, you lose a lot. Like, before you become good, yeah, like, you lose a lot. And when I mean a lot, it took me like 12, 14 years before I got good in the sport. So I think that helped me in today's world. When things happen, I just continue moving forward. Right? Like, yeah, whatever. It was a roadblocker. Let's continue. So when I review what happened there, I think the organization might have not been ready for that moment. And as we know, there is the financial goal of the institutions that also needs to be met. And sometimes accessibility is seen as one of those, like, well, how many people are we actually helping? Is that in my goal? That's the mentality for certain companies. And it's just sad. And you bring the business case and let them know, like, this is not what you think it is. It's actually opening and broadening, doing the greater and the things. But I think there has to be a support from the top to the bottom for organizations to become more accessible friendly, but it also has to be pushed from the bottom up, and we meet at the middle kind of thing, right? Like, if no one is advocating for it, C-level going down and asking for that to happen, like, you know, great, but it's not, yeah, not happen.
I feel like this transitions well into, like, what is your biggest frustration in your career, and is it still happening?
I think my frustration is, in all honesty, I wish, like, companies that I work with, either clients or companies that I work for, have their own accessibility office. I wish they had it, like a place where we have that group of people. Because typically what I learned, not all of the companies are this way, but some of them have advocates or people that are caring for it, but it's spread in small pieces all over the place. So when I go to organizations and I see that, it's sad because, you know, those people can get frustrated and eventually they could leave to a better opportunities. You know that they try to do the best for what they believe is the best, that the work that they should be doing. And it's that disconnect between the organization goals and the personal goal of the employee. Yeah.
One of the criticisms that we sometimes hear about accessibility offices is that if you centralize accessibility in a single place, now either everything has to go through the accessibility office and it's like a big blocker on everything, or they centralize all the accessibility and sort of shove it off to the side and then just go on doing things without bothering to consult the accessibility office. And so there's this sort of desire to spread accessibility out through teams. What do you think about that? How do you respond to that? Have you seen it? How can it be avoided? That kind of thing.
The office should be considered as the strategy place. The way I see it is like the accessibility office should be like the one thinking of what trainings do we need? What money, what budget do we need? What requirements do we have? Do we have like need for physical space improvement? Do we have to, I don't know, create certain things? And that's someone that needs to be thinking about it day to day. And then you have the operators. And that's where the knowledge should be spread, not just in this office. Because again, the office can be one person. And if you have an organization of 500, then it's a blocker. That person is a blocker. So the goal of this organization or the center of excellence should be, what is the strategy? How are we going to increase our maturity in this organization when it comes to accessibility? Because the goal is everyone, or at least the majority of the people within the office, should know what accessibility is. They should know how to work for it. And if they don't know and they're learning, at least they should know who to go to, right? When you hire in a company, if you go to a quick training in like, hey, we're super diverse, we're inclusive, and we have accessibility, and if you're interested or you have any issues, go to this person. At least you get that from the day one, and like the moment they join the organization. So yeah, I think in those cases, I think it might be because they're not set properly, but who am I to judge? Because we all, like I said earlier, we are trying to be better and help. And I think we will learn. Right? Like, it's just, we learn, we adapt, and then we continue changing and moving forward.
I think that's true and important. And maybe it's about measuring process outcomes, right? And and setting targets and things like that. I hear you about the strategic element. There is so much information being spread about accessibility and about disability that is maybe not as accurate as it could be and as we wish it was. So what myth around disability do you see that you want to bust?
An easy one that isn't an easy answer, that accessibility is expensive for the companies to provide, right? Like, I think it's just a win-win situation. If the services, applications, whatever you want to call it, services that we are providing are accessible, we are not only helping others, we're also, if you look at it from the financial point of view for the institution, we are helping them make money. So like I always say to my organization, please let me help you make more money by being more accessible. Mm-hmm. If your goal is to make money, here's a way to make more money. In my point of view is like, let me help people, right? Let me help people to get access to this information or to this application or to these spaces. So there's a win-win. So the myth, I think there's wording for this. Again, it's not my first language, but the myth will be like, accessibility is expensive.
And hard, right? Sometimes people are so afraid of accessibility that they never do it.
It's the fear of the unknown, right? Like you never know. Again, and I'm an athlete, so I did triathlons for a while. The first time that I ever guided a blind runner was interesting, I would say, because I was not used to it. So, right, that uncomfortable first date again. Like, we go together, we're going to meet here. And then, okay, what am I supposed to be guiding you through? So that uncertainty for me made it hard. So I think my heart rate was way higher, and I put much effort in that run that I have ever had because simply being afraid. Mm-hmm. So like you say, Samuel, it's just hard. But what made it harder was not knowing. Once you know a little bit about it, you get more comfortable. You get, oh, okay, it wasn't, you know. I was worried about things that I shouldn't have.
I mean, if folks are listening to this podcast who haven't quite started their journey yet, and who are maybe sometimes doing the thing that we do when we're worried about a thing and we're just sort of like doing all kinds of research so that we don't actually have to do anything, right? I'm sure we've all done that. What advice would you give to those people who might be listening who need to help them get beyond the fear and actually start doing the thing?
And I always recommend this to people that work with me. Be curious and be vocal. If you don't know, say that you don't know and ask. Don't be afraid to ask. Contact people in the network. Do a lot of research, investigate, read articles. Like Samuel is saying, there are some out there that are not, you know, ideal, like any news that we have today in the world. We need to filter them down. would get to know the experts in the field, ask them, like email, social media, whatever. They are really open. Asking is not a thing. And the worst that can happen, you ask, you get no answer, or you get a reaction. From one of the reactions that you might get in this community, I'm sure you will get 20 that have open doors that will help you answer those questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how I started getting into this, is like started following people on LinkedIn and on Twitter and on Instagram. And I feel like just within a small span of time, I've learned a bunch. We're getting kind of close to the end with our questions. And so there's a question we love to ask, and which is, what is the first piece of technology you remember using, and what was it for?
I think there are two examples. So I have an older brother, so I always inherited things. Within one of them, technology being the other one. Or toys. I also say Lego, the little play game. I inherited a lot of toys that were not complete. So I was supposed to have like a vehicle to construct a truck, but I didn't have either the engine or the wheels. I got something of it, spring mechanism, and it had like the doors, but I didn't have the complete element to make the car that I was supposed to make. So I think that would have been my first technology piece of it. Never got to build the car, always been frustrated about it, but it was interesting. And the second real technology that I use that is to my line of work today, my dad, a doctor, he had a computer, a home office computer. It was a screen that had only two colors, black and orange. And it was one of those orange. It was orange. It was fun though. It was. He had one of those turbo buttons. So to increase the processing speed, you press a button and it had a turbo on it. So I was a kid, right? So there was a person helping my dad build a software and he installed a game for me. He's like, hey, do you like gaming? Like, I never played a game, whatever. So he showed me how to game in it and it was a karate game. The turbo button was great when I was attacking. You press the turbo, hit, take the turbo out. The other guy, he was awesome. He was like fantastic. So that was the real technology usage that I had.
It's so interesting that both of those good examples really probably shaped you, right? Because they both kind of involve having to use or do things in ways that are maybe not intended or that are a little bit different, right? You don't have all the pieces you cheated the game. No, I'm kidding.
Cheater. Yeah, I was.
I know you have the Ally Tips on Twitter. Where you post things and you post sources. And, you know, this is an ongoing conversation and we're all learning and networking and working together. And so folks want to continue the conversation with you. Where can they find you? What's the best way to get in touch and to keep up with what you're doing?
So, yes, I just presented in the AXCOM conference. I would have been like March 15 or so. I was talking about accessibility in e-commerce. Basically, destructuring the site. And where are some areas that we have difficulties when we speak about e-commerce accessibility, the point of view of a designer and a front-end developer. I will add notes, technical notes in my website, alitips.com. So yeah, make sure to go there and I will have the slides and all the notes of the conference and technical advices in there. Yeah, so there are two places that I'm really active. So Twitter, I'm trying to get better at it, but it's alitips. I couldn't find that handle, so I have to use A11Y_tips. So I'm really active there. And LinkedIn is where I'm mostly active. So that will be my name, Hector.Osborne.Rodriguez. We might have to put a link somewhere so that people can go in it.
We will.
Put a link in the show notes.
Because it's a really long name. But yeah, LinkedIn is where I'm more active and Twitter, the second space that I'm at.
Thank you so much for being here. This was a lovely conversation.
Awesome. You was. Yeah. Thank you very much. You guys are a great host.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Prue and Nikki Nolan. Edited and produced by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. Theme music is created by F.A. Achman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram @DisabilityBandwidth or on our website at disabilitybandwidth.com.